Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Cairo, Egypt, to speak with Hussein Shabka, Professor of Sociology at American University in Cairo. He has been observing the historic presidential elections underway and will discuss his findings, which indicate that an aggressive effort by Saudi Arabia to buy the vote may have backfired with Egyptian voters after enormous amounts of money in support of Islamic fundamentalists had poured in from the Gulf. Then we'll look into successful efforts by a bipartisan group of congressmen led by John Conyers and Ron Paul to insert language into the National Defense Authorization Act to undeclare war with Iran. Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy with the Quaker Lobby, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, joins us to discuss this significant step to slow the momentum in Congress towards war with Iran. Then finally, we'll be joined by Flint Leverett, who was the Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council from 1992 to 2003. We will look into the just-concluded P5+1 talks with Iran that yielded no breakthrough and ended with significant differences remaining, which presumably will be dealt with in Moscow in the next round of talks starting on June the 18th. And joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Hussein Shabka, who's a professor of sociology at American University in Cairo. And as a sociologist, Hussein Shabka, I take it that you did your own field work today on the second day of the Egyptian presidential elections.
Right, yes, yeah.
And what did you observe?
It went surprisingly well, very well organized, surprisingly small number of violations. Despite the great deal of excitement, everybody's excited because they're voting for the first time in their lives in a free election, so they are excited. But nevertheless, it was muted in terms of not disrupting the process.
But I understand there's been some acrimony between the former head of the Arab League, Aram Musa, and Mr. Shafiq. They've been trading charges, accusing each other of sinister rumors, and that they broke the agreement not to go on the media during the election days. Have you been following this?
Yes, but that's par for the course. I mean, they all broke the rules. Everybody broke the rules. But there was nothing really serious. And it's understandable that they would attack each other and try to do whatever they can to undermine their vote. But there was nothing serious.
So it was just a continuation of the election campaign, right?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
So most of the analysis that we hear is basically that this will be a competition between people from the former regime in the form of Ahmed Shafiq, the former Air Force general, and a colleague of Mubarak's, and Ahmed Musa, the former foreign minister of Egypt, and the two candidates from the Muslim Brotherhood. That's the reporting we get.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that's the way it looks to you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
So what about Hamdin Shabati,
the socialist? I think he's going to do better than expected. He's nowhere near as high. I don't think he's going to be anywhere near as high as the main contenders, but he's going to do better than expected.
And he is the only kind of secular, the one that would arguably be representing the original Tahrir Square revolution, right? My understanding is that the people that brought about the revolution feel that they've basically lost control of the politics.
Well, they have. They certainly have. Because the revolution's strength was that it had no leaders, but that was also its main weakness.
And clearly the military have been pulling the strings all along and ever since.
Yes, and they're likely to continue to pull the strings for the foreseeable future. Even if you get the perfect candidate tomorrow, it's not easy to end 60 years of military dictatorship overnight.
So the support that apparently the Air Force General Ahmed Shafiq is getting, I hear that that's based upon a desire amongst the Egyptian people, or at least a substantial segment of the Egyptian people, for stability.
And, absolutely. That is his biggest pulling point.
Right, but isn't there also a real possibility that the instability is being caused by the military? Because under Mubarak, there were thousands and thousands of thugs on the payrolls to enforce the dictatorship.
Yes, they certainly were. But I don't think the military is interested in instability. I think they know that the Egyptians generally, from pharaonic times, value stability beyond anything else. They are terrified of chaos. And that is one of the things that has continued to be a feature of the Egyptians since pharaonic times. And that is, I think, something that the military has realized, and I think the military wants stability.
So, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Hussein Shabka, who's a professor of sociology at the American University in Cairo, and he has been observing the vote today and yesterday for the presidential elections in Egypt, which, of course, followed the parliamentary elections, where the Muslim Brotherhood, along with the Salafist, more fundamentalist parties, dominate the legislature. Is there a possibility that we're seeing a kind of pragmatism and maturity in the Egyptian voters, in the sense that here in the United States, quite often, American voters give the Congress to one party and the presidency to the other? You think that's going to happen?
I don't think it's that sophisticated. I think it's more than anything, fear of chaos. And I think one of the advantages of what has happened, even though it was wrong at the time, was the fact that they had the parliamentary elections and the Islamic faction has won most of the seats, because that meant that people now see what they're like. I have met a surprising number of people from very limited incomes who have actually voted for the Islamic faction in the parliamentary elections and who said that they wouldn't vote for them again.
And is that because they promised not to participate in the presidential elections and reneged on that promise?
It's one of the many promises that they reneged on. Their Muslim brothers, in terms of the popular support, their main point of interest is all the money they have. They have endless amounts of money from the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the oil countries. And that's what gives them the strength. Without this money, they wouldn't be anywhere near where they are now.
So you could make the case then, Hussein Shabka, professor of sociology at American University in Cairo, you could make the case that Saudi Arabia is interfering in the Egyptian elections.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. They always did.
Right.
But
they really want a kind of theocratic government. Is that what you're telling us?
They want a government that will do their bidding, and they don't want a progressive government because that would be a threat to them.
And in terms of the candidates that are running for president, is there anybody that fits the Saudi Arabian model?
I don't think they would be unhappy with either Ahmed Shafiq or Amr Moussa, because I think they realize that neither one of them would be a threat to them.
But what about the two Muslim Brotherhood candidates, Fattoush and Morsi?
It's a love-hate relationship between them. They support them, but they fear them.
Because they're too liberal in their Islamic practices?
Yes.
And too tolerant?
And they disapprove of a lot of things that are going on in Saudi Arabia.
In terms of...
They disapprove of monarchy, for example.
I see. And what about Wahhabism?
These are the Salafis. These are the people who appeared suddenly out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Before the revolution, they declared that it would be a sin to participate in the revolution.
And then,
they appeared suddenly because they have so much money.
Right.
So they are really their main supporters. They are the closest to the Saudi ideology, Wahhabi ideology.
And then on the other side, on the liberal secular side, they're obviously the people that started the revolution. They feel betrayed, right?
Oh, yes. The whole atmosphere in the revolution, when I went down the first couple of days, the people who were in Tahrir Square were very, very different from the people who went to Tahrir Square after the first two or three days. It was mainly young, educated, secular people. Some of them actually came from religious backgrounds, but they were not there for religious reasons. They were there for secular reasons, and the chants were for Egypt, not for any particular party.
So what has happened since is that the military, under its Supreme Council, that has been the ruling body since the revolution, they have clearly controlled the situation, controlled who got to run for the presidency, for example, found ways to marginalize the secular, educated and young. And the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has, of course, promised a fair vote. You say today, I believe 50 million people are eligible to vote. I don't know how many did vote. Any sense of what the turnout was?
No, but I suspect it's going to be high.
But isn't there something fundamentally wrong here that you're voting for both a parliament and a presidency before there's a constitution?
Absolutely, yes. But that was one of the mistakes that the military did because of their lack of experience. I don't think there were any ulterior motives other than simple lack of experience and the fact that the Muslim Brothers wanted the parliamentary elections as soon as they possibly could because they thought they would be able to win a lot of seats. So you had these two factors, and that's what caused the unusual situation that we're in.
So is the military going to go back to their barracks? My understanding is that they have a pervasive influence over the Egyptian economy.
Oh, they do.
And there's lots and lots of businesses that they control. What's your sense of what the day after is going to look like? Whether, I imagine, if they get their candidate, either Al-Musa or Shafiq, nothing is going to change, right? Now, would it be fair to say that the only possible challenge to this continued military rule, whether it's overt or covert, would be the Muslim Brotherhood candidates?
Yes.
And what's the likelihood? Obviously, the vote's just taken place. There's no way to know which side won, whether the former regime won or the two moderate Islamists that were allowed to run.
I think the only thing that is more or less certain is that there's going to be a rerun.
A runoff.
Nobody's
right.
going to win an outright majority, and they'll have to have a rerun.
Right, a runoff. And that's supposed to take place, is it the 17th or the...
Yeah, 17th of June, yeah.
That's quite soon, so...
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll know in a day or so, I take by Friday, who's going to be in the runoff.
Yeah, we will.
I see. But what's your overall sense that either way, what? Either way, the military are going to win? Is that...
Oh, I think so.
It's that...
Oh, I think so. I think you cannot simply erase the influence of the military on Egypt, and I don't think it would be desirable to do that anyway. It would be too much of a shock for society. I think the harm that was done in Egypt by the 1952 coup that started the military dictatorship cannot be undone in months or years. It's going to take many years.
But haven't the Egyptian military, I remember at Tahrir Square, they were the heroes, but I take it that a lot of the luster has come off and that they're not quite held in such high esteem.
Yes, yeah, that's true. The military, the only reason the military did not fire on people in Tahrir Square and came out in support of the people rather than Mubarak was that they simply didn't want his son.
So,
that was their main problem.
I see. So it was just that the Mubarak family were just too greedy.
Yeah, they were far too greedy, and the son was far too arrogant. He's absolutely loaded.
And what do you think of the possible presidency of Ahmed Shafiq? I mean, it's odd that he's a Air Force general and a former fighter pilot, and he was very close to Mubarak, wasn't he?
He was, yes, but... He was not corrupt. There's been nothing to show any kind of corruption at all. And if there had been anything, it would have come out. He was a good manager. He ran the Ministry of Aviation well. And so he's got a good reputation from that point of view. If he hadn't made the mistake of accepting to head the government in the last few days under Mubarak, he'd have been in a much, much better position. That's the main thing that people have against him.
But that was largely because of Mubarak's desperation, wasn't it?
He was trying to
find somebody that could put on a good face.
Yeah.
And accusations that he made money out of land deals in airports that were built under his ministry.
No, that's baseless.
They were kickbacks.
Nobody's been able to prove anything.
Right. I think, if anything, they were probably kickbacks to the Mubarak family.
But yeah, I mean, they were unbelievably corrupt.
Right, right. So what's your general feeling then on this day, this historic day? Do you feel that something historic has happened here?
Yes, I do. I feel optimistic.
And in spite of the extent to which the military's hand is still there, you feel that this is an important step forward?
Yes, it is. The military are not interested in staying in power. They want to stay in the background, but they're not interested in staying in power.
But they still want their privileges.
Yes, absolutely.
And you,
there's no doubt about that, yes.
And you can live with that.
One has to be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
They've been there for 60 years, and you can't just wipe them out in 2 minutes.
And you have no fears, given the amount of money that the Saudis and the Gulf are pouring in there to turn Egypt into a theocracy. You don't think that the Saudis are going to be successful?
No, I think whatever gains they made, the nature of the Egyptian people is far too moderate in the long term for the Wahhabi, for them to accept the Wahhabi ideology. They'll make gains in the short term, but in the long term, no.
And just in closing, you think that what happened in the parliamentary elections and this surprise appearance of the Salafists, that's had a backlash, that the Egyptian people...
It has. I have been very surprised at the number of lower-income people that I talk to, and I ask everybody I meet, who are you going to vote for, and who do you like, and who do you dislike. And I had been very, very surprised at the number of people who criticized the Muslim Brothers for their performance in the parliament, and the number of those people who said that they would never vote for them again.
And the,
obviously, it's not a scientific poll. I did not do research. It was just personal observance.
Sure. But these were poor and working-class people who would normally vote for the Brotherhood.
Who have voted for the Brotherhood and for the parliamentary elections.
But not again.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, and I really appreciate you joining us here to give us a flavor of what happened today. And I thank you for joining us, Hussein Shabka.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Hussein Shabka, who's a professor of sociology at the American University in Cairo. He has been traveling around for the last 2 days observing the Egyptian elections firsthand, and he gave us a very interesting report. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the undeclaration of war with Iran.